Hello and welcome to the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast for the 29th of June 2014. My name's T.R.P. Watson, and this week I'm joined by Nick from Partially Obstructed View, Gareth James and Johnny Fox. We're now going to talk about Enduring Song at the Southwark Playhouse. This is a play by Jesse Britton, who had a minor success at the old Southwark Playhouse with his play Bound, which I think was about a fishing community and a storm at sea. And it was a short and heavily movementy play, I think we agreed before we started recording. This play, he's become a little bit more ambitious, and yes, I'm always a bit careful about using that word. So we are in France, 1096. Matthew, a young French knight, sets out on the First Crusade and leaves behind him a broken family and actually a large number of women. What it seems to be here is that the men all go off to war and the women have to stay at home and look after the farm. This immediately rang a few alarm bells for me, because I was under the impression that in 1096 France was a feudal country, and the idea of having the family farm, having a family farm, was not quite what was done. I mean, that's much more of an 18th century thing. So what I ended up with this, in this play, was I started thinking of, you've sort of got the First Crusades, and he does the First Crusades historically quite well. There are some interesting points which I'll probably get to about that, but he also gives us a sort of women at home struggling, trying to keep a farm going against creditors, against the church who kind of own the land that they're renting from, trying to take it back, and some wicked landowners. And this is set in Provence, which is, of course, the territory used by Marcel Pagnol in his novels, which we probably better known as films in this country, Jean de Floriette and Manon des Sources. And so I kept thinking, is this him being inspired by those two things in his tale of the difficulties over the farm, which are intercut with not bad pieces on, historically speaking, pieces on the First Crusade. He's kind of conflated a character in it. He has this sort of group of four young men who go off to war and join the Crusade. This group of four friends, and they are led by a bishop called Bishop Peter, who's kind of a cross between a character called Peter the Hermit, who led a people's crusade as part of the First Crusades, and a monk called Peter Bartholomew, who, after the siege of Antioch, said he discovered the lance that pierces Christ's breast at the crucifixion, and this is the thing that's supposed to have finally killed Christ. This is the sort of a holy relic, which was apparently allowed you to be invincible in battle. So you have this character of Peter Bartholomew who discovers it, and it's sort of conflated into the idea of Bishop Peter, and the same basic things happen to him. And historically, they kind of get things right. We get introduced to these three brothers who are kind of the leaders of the First Crusade, and one of them ends up becoming King of Jerusalem. It's an odd mix of this pastoral drama in France, in Provence, and this historical journey through the Holy Land in the First Crusade, and I'm not entirely sure it's done that well. It is big, it's ambitious, and it's very woolly. And Jesse Britton also directed this, and I got the impression sometimes that he thought that his writing's great, and when he thinks his writing's great, he gets his actors to shout it, and it isn't always great in that sense. It was actually rather grating. So yeah, I think I was somewhat disappointed by this. Nick, what do you think of it?
Well, I wasn't somewhat disappointed. I was spectacularly disappointed by it. It's Bound was kind of a small, intimate, quite short piece that kind of went in there and knew exactly what it was doing and sort of delivered what it had to deliver. This is nearly 3 hours of very cut. It's just really dull. It's kind of, I mean, you know, I'm not as much of a history expert, so I'll take your word for it that it's largely accurate. But I mean, maybe that's part of the problem. Maybe he's, you know, Jesse Britton's been focusing on getting enough of the history right and not particularly on getting anything to work theatrically. And it's just really bloated and very dull and quite irritating to watch, because he's got this very big cast, and I don't think he quite knows what to do with them. So you've got a lot of performances that, like you say, are just too big and too shouty, and then you've got performances that should kind of carry a bit more charisma but are just a bit too flat and wooden. So it's just an absolute mess, unfortunately. You know, I mean, there are some people who look like they might have some decent acting talent in there, but no, I don't think anybody really gets a chance to do anything. It's just all over the place. And the first hour is sort of the lead up to these characters leaving the village and going off to the Crusades. And I mean, in theory, you see where that's a good idea, because you're getting to know who these people are in their own setting, and then see how sort of the war affects them. But you don't actually get to know anything about them in that first hour, because there's an awful lot of... The whole first hour just feels like padding, because there's so many scenes in which this Bishop Peter turns up and kind of ominously hints that Matthew's going to have to be drafted to the Crusade. And, I mean, it's obvious that that's what he's there for from the second he steps onto the stage. But there's about four or five scenes after that during which we're kind of building up to, oh, no, I know what you're going to ask my son to do. And, you know, it's like, yeah, so do all of us. And just do it and actually get on with it. But it does kind of... I thought it failed on every level. I did slightly worry when I'd written my review that I might have accidentally made it look like it was so bad it's good, because it does have some... It does have some moments which are just quite clumsily written and, you know, and performed at times, and there were occasions when I kind of got the giggles watching them trying to be deadly serious with something that was kind of just not that great. It really isn't even sort of so bad it's entertaining. I just didn't find it entertaining at all, and it's a shame, because, you know, ambition can pay off, but it really hasn't here. And I think it's a big... I don't know what Jesse Britton might have done between Bound and this at other venues. All I know of him is what he's done at Southwark Playhouse, and it is a big jump from that perspective, and to me it looks like too big a jump. And as you say, he directs his own work. I generally don't like that. I don't like writers directing their own work, because I think, you know, they're part of a director's job is to have kind of a second perspective to the writer as to exactly what the qualities of the piece of writing are. And I think it doesn't always happen, but it certainly happens here, where there's no kind of independent eye on what really doesn't work. So the things that really don't work are quite happily pushed into the foreground and allowed to kind of just sit there in front of the audience, while there's a very kind of non-plus looking audience by the end of it. It's in the round, so you can see what everybody else's reactions are like. And there were a couple of people fleeing at the interval, or even kind of during the show, and the people who left were definitely kind of not really sure what they'd just sat through by the end. So yeah, I just can't recommend this on any level.
We're now going to talk about Mr. Burns at the Almeida Theatre. This is described as a post-electric play by writer Anne Washburn, and it's directed by Robert Icke. There are lots of interesting ideas in this, and the basic interesting idea here is that we are in a post-apocalyptic America. Something absolutely disastrous has happened. There is no power, there's no electricity, and people are living a sort of hand-to-mouth existence. And we meet a group of people who've got together around a campfire, and they're trying to remember an episode from The Simpsons. It's an episode of The Simpsons, I think, called Cape Fear, which is a takeoff of a couple of Cape Fear films. There was a very, very flash one, I think Spielberg directed, starring Robert De Niro, around about the time that this particular Simpsons episode was first broadcast. And The Simpsons remade it to have somebody that Bart Simpson, the sort of hero, the child hero of the Simpsons series, has got incarcerated, a character called Sideshow Bob. And Sideshow Bob gets released from prison and decides to take revenge, much like in the film Cape Fear, on the person who put him away. The plot is sort of a half-hour story, and you have these people trying to remember this story and trying to piece it together and arguing about the various elements of the story. And we see a stranger coming into around their campfire. They're very suspicious of him, but he kind of wins them over by knowing a bit of additional information about this particular Simpsons episode. And they build a level of trust. They also have this rather fascinating idea of you have a number of people that you want to trace, and there's sort of been an agreement with people passing through and passing by them that you have 10 people that you wish to hang on to, and so you describe them and write them down. So everybody is carrying little books of names that are said and people who've come through or they've encountered. And it's a clever idea. Then we move on after an interval, at which it has to be said some people around me left because I think they couldn't quite handle the whole thing of Simpsons. They were expressing confusion about the Simpsons. And I think this is something I'll get back to, that people, perhaps if you didn't get the Simpsons, that first scene would have been meaningless and silly and, just not something you would understand. But the second scene we get 7 years later where things have settled down a little bit. It's still a bit wild, it's still a bit reckless, and the group of survivors we first saw, with one or two additions, have started being a theatre company, and their theatre is old Simpsons episodes and extravaganzas based on the commercial breaks in a Simpsons episode. So they work that out, they trade for lines and ideas from the Simpsons with people all around who they encounter when they're doing their show. Their show is some kind of travelling show, and they're in competition with others who perhaps are a slightly better theatre company but are also doing Simpsons episodes. And then finally, in the final scene, there is this crazy, almost like you think of those Chinese operas, which are very strange, the sort of Chinese communist operas. And it's a sort of rendition of the original Cape Fear episode, this time using the main bad guy from The Simpsons, who's a man called Mr. Burns, who owns a nuclear power plant and is very rich and extremely old and very, very evil. And he becomes the antagonist in the episode instead of the character called Sideshow Bob. And it sort of recreates the episode, and it's completely out there, it's completely mad. Almost the only concession to the original is you have Jenna Russell playing Bart Simpson, the boy hero of The Simpsons, is played in real life by Yeardley Smith, who's an actress. So it's a good concession to the original story. But of course it's taken on a completely new meaning. It's much more serious. It's much more operatic, and it's trying to piece together the human condition. It is very well done, and especially that final sequence. I'm not a big man for musicals, and I didn't really think too much of the music here, but the final scene is wonderfully weird and cleverly done and really powerful in many ways. I don't know that I particularly liked the play. I thought it was a bit languorous in places, but it's certainly that last scene really made it up for me. But it is, of course, a worry that, firstly, that we have people who don't know The Simpsons, which is why I got people walking out of the performance I saw. But also that people here perhaps don't understand the huge cultural relevance of The Simpsons in America. I mean, it is huge there. People quote things from it and people talk about it a lot all the time. It is a very major cultural influence in America. It's not, I mean, here, yeah, you know, it is shown quite a lot, but I don't think it's really taken hold. I don't think it's really entered people's souls in the way that it has in America. So I think that it's slightly alien here, and you slightly think, well, yeah, if I worship The Simpsons more, I would get this. And some people have said, well, you know, why wouldn't they go for the Bible and Shakespeare? And perhaps the answer to that is because they wouldn't. It's not, neither of those are as well known as cultural icons that people can get around. And The Simpsons, well, it almost is. I mean, obviously, the writer has just taken something that is popular. I mean, she could have taken Gilligan's Island or something, or Love Boat or something like that instead. But she's taken The Simpsons because it is believably something that people would hang on to and talk about and or even try to recreate. So I think there's lots of clever ideas, and that's often something that's said about science fiction somewhat dismissively. You know, it's clever ideas, but the writing's not that good. I think the writing's decent here. I think it's an interesting story and well performed. What do you think about it, Gareth?
Well, I thought it was clever and I thought it was original, but it was very long drawn out and frankly, just a bit dull, really. So I guess my one-word review would be indifference. I'm not a Simpsons fan, and when I got wind of the fact that might affect my enjoyment, I tried to track down a copy of that episode, but failed. But what I was able to do was read a synopsis of the episode. And even though I haven't seen The Simpsons, I haven't seen a whole episode, I don't think, to be honest. But I've kind of, it's passed me by in visiting friends' houses where it's been on and that kind of thing. I actually don't think it matters as much as people say it does that you don't know The Simpsons, to be honest, because I think effectively she's chosen the Simpsons to represent popular culture, to make this point that, you know, we cling on to popular culture, that popular culture unites us in adversity, that, you know, I have friends who you go around who quote lines from Monty Python and Fawlty Towers on a regular basis. So I think all she's trying to do is she's trying to sort of make this point about popular culture, really. So I honestly didn't think it mattered that much. And I think if a British writer had done it, there might have been sort of Monty Python or Fawlty Towers or Coronation Street or The Archers. But so I actually don't think that does affect your enjoyment. I think the reason people leave at the first interval is because they've sat through 40 minutes in virtual darkness of some people sitting around a fire, and they've been bored to death, frankly. And I think the another chunk of people that leave at the end of the second part sort of give it a bit longer, but are still sort of not getting anywhere with it, so they leave as well. I did stay for the whole thing, but at the end of the evening, I left thinking, so what? I think, you know, you can't fault the idea, I don't think. You can't fault its execution. I think both, you know, the direction and the design is very good. Some very good performances there. But I just thought it was a very heavy-handed, very overblown piece, really. And I just left feeling very indifferent about the whole thing. So I'm not in the camp of, I hate it, or I'm not one of the walkers. I'm not in the raves camp either. In fact, I frankly, even if you're a Simpsons fan, can't understand how you could possibly rave about anything quite so dull. I'm just in the middle, indifferent. And, well, that sums me up. I was expecting to hate, I was expecting actually to hate it, but I didn't hate it. I just, as I said.
And I'm going to talk about The Valley of Astonishment at the Young Vic. This is a play directed by Peter Brook and Mary Helen Estienne, and stars Catherine Hunter, Marcello Magni, and Jared McNeil. Gareth, tell me more about this and what you thought of it.
Well, this is the second Peter Brook play that's kind of anchored in neuroscience. About 20 years ago, he adapted Oliver Sacks' book, The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, and he's come back to similar territory, not the same subject, but similar territory, 20 years later with this piece, which is really just a short 75-minute piece with, in addition to those three actors you mentioned, a couple of musicians and a very minimalist staging, just a few chairs and tables, to tell the story of synesthesia, I suppose. And he takes as his starting point a book, I think it's a 1980s book, by a Russian neuropsychologist who's called Alexander Luria. And in this book, Luria has a case study of a man who has an extraordinary memory. And that was the kind of starting point for this. And they've taken this idea, this case study idea, and turned it into a woman now in America, I think, who's a journalist. And she goes to work on her first day, and her boss challenges her because she doesn't appear to have made any notes during a meeting. And then she reveals that she's memorized almost everything that happened at the meeting, and he realizes she has this extraordinary talent, and sends her to some neuroscience researchers that he knows, who then kind of examine her and start sort of looking at her particular case. He eventually, well, quite soon sacks her, which I think is a bit of an odd thing. He sacks her because he thinks that the job is way below her talents, and suggests she goes on stage and introduces her to an agent who does indeed put her on stage, you know, in one of these kind of variety shows, I suppose, as the memory woman. And she's doing that by night, and then with the researchers by day. So it's really an examination of the condition of synesthesia and the positives of it, the extraordinary memory and things like that, but also the negatives of it as well, which reveal themselves particularly during her performances. It's actually a very simple and very gentle piece of storytelling, really. And I wasn't so keen on The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, but I actually enjoyed this a lot more because somehow this one kind of drew me in and kind of captivated me. I felt the writing had a sort of lightness of touch about it, and the performances, particularly from Catherine Hunter, I thought were actually entertaining. They actually were very enjoyable to watch. And they all play more than one role, although Catherine Hunter only one other role, I think. The musicians are quite important because this kind of musical soundtrack or musical soundscape, I think, does add a lot to it. And I enjoyed it very much. I think my experience was enhanced. There was on the night I went, there's a Q&A after the show. It wasn't the sort of classic Q&A with the cast and the director or the writer or whatever. It was the two directors, but it was also two synesthetes, I think they're called, two people who have this condition, together with a professor of neuroscience from Cambridge University. So the discussion was much more open than just the play. It was also about what it represented and what it was trying to tell us. And I have to say that did add value for me to the evening. And I think the two things together, I think, added up to more than just the performance itself. And I think it was, so it left me sort of feeling very satisfied, really, as if I kind of learned quite a lot. But I felt as if I was entertained as well. And I was very, very pleased that I went. I've kind of not been so mad keen on Peter Brook's work as he's become more minimalist, really. My first introduction to him was a 9-hour epic in a tram shed in Glasgow when he staged the unstageable, the Marbarata. And as he's got more minimalist with things like this and the Oliver Sacks play and The Suit and other things, I've kind of been less engaged with the work. But this is the better, I think, of these later pieces. The only thing I didn't quite get about it was I didn't really... He bookends the piece by parts of a Persian poem called The Conference of the Birds, which I think he's used before. But the reason for doing that and just kind of went over my head, to be honest. So I wasn't sure about that. But in all other respects, I found it a very captivating and enjoyable experience.
Yeah, I always worry about Peter Brook because I've never really got what is so special about him. I mean, of course, what is so special about him is sort of was worked out 40 years ago. I mean, he's been a major influence on theatre for years and years and years, and sort of almost my entire life, I think. So everybody's sort of taken what all the directors who want to follow him have taken what they want to from him, from what he's done, and all the directors who don't want to have anything to do with him are sort of reacting against him. So it's difficult to see. I've always looked at it and said, well, okay, what's so special about this? It's not that it's bad. It's just what is it about Peter Brook that is so wonderful? I mean, I saw bits of the Mahabharata when it was shown on television, but it's not something I've really followed. And of course, you've heard of the very famous Midsummer Night's Dream that he did, where everybody was spinning plates and doing other magical things. And again, very simple, but that his idea is of very simple staging and people, not really dressing up too much. It's something I always like and actually quite like in theatre generally. So obviously he's had that kind of influence on my thinking, if nothing else. But I found this, you said minimalist, and I think that's possibly what my problem is. I did have a few too many questions about it. You don't really find out this woman's sort of prehistory before she starts telling her story. There's not really a lot about her life. And when you've got somebody like Catherine Hunter who could have spent 2 hours telling you about this woman's life, and it would have been absolutely fascinating from her, and you just didn't get too much of that, and I thought that was a bit of a pity. It's also some of the case histories they do, because they don't just do her, they do other people with these conditions, and they don't really do too much with them, and I would have liked more of it. And I did think afterwards that it's sort of a similar area to things like the Theatre de Complicité have done, and I thought, couldn't help thinking, well,
if Complicité had done it, they would have done it slightly differently. You would have got a lot more. You would have got a lot more richness in there. You wouldn't have got, as you say, very very minimal staging, the very quiet staging. So I did find it somewhat insubstantial, but not bad, but kind of disappointing for that. I didn't stick around for the Q&A. There was a Q&A I went as well. I didn't really stick around for that. I wanted to see more and more detail and have a slightly richer experience from it, because you have people like Catherine Hunter and Marcello Magni. You know, they are wonderful presences on stage, and it's always a great treat to see them. And I just wanted to see a lot more and have a lot more a detail filled in, and I thought it was a pity that we didn't get that.
I think the reason you don't get earlier life or backstory is that, frankly, it doesn't matter. I think what he's trying to do is he's trying to sort of present the condition, if you like, rather than the characters. I think it's about characterization. It's actually about the condition that he's trying to tell us about. And indeed, you know, to make us kind of in awe of the human mind, really, because I think it's much more about what the mind can do and how, you know, this is the one thing we don't really understand. You know, we understand less than just about anything else in science, really. And Catherine Hunter, I just think, is she, in this particular piece, she's very good at sort of small things, at expressions and hand gestures and things like that. And I think she shows a different, more restrained side of her acting. And my companion asked we were at the same performance, by the way. My companion asked a question at the Q&A which required Catherine Hunter to come on stage to answer the question, because the question was about the research the actors did in order to do it. And then after the Q&A, we went to talk to Catherine Hunter, who was positively charming and very engaging. But she made a huge point of suggesting that you really should read this Luria book, this Alexander Luria book, because she felt it was the most important kind of important book of the subject and very much the source of the story. I understand your point about it being sort of, you know, in some ways insubstantial, but I don't know, for some reason it just, you know, on this occasion, it just drew me into the story of the condition, if you like. And perhaps that's why I enjoyed it more than you, although maybe also because the Q&A, maybe also the Q&A added something as well, perhaps.
We're now going to talk about Carousel at the Arcola Theatre. This is Rodgers and Hammerstein's musical and is directed by Luke Fredericks. John, tell me more about this production and what you thought of it.
I thought this production was wonderful. And having seen so many carousels over the years, including the glorious Mick Heitner one at the National, that kind of reawakened interest in it as a musical. And a very, very good Mount View student production at the Landor that I thought was also clever and musically excellent, as this one is. But what the team at the Arcola have done is really deconstruct what is possibly the grandest and most kind of vaulting of the Rodgers and Hammerstein musicals. It's often said that it is the opera Richard Rodgers wanted to write, but Oscar Hammerstein didn't want to write an opera. So this is as musically ambitious as it's possible to be while still retaining the stage musical form with some dialogue. And the arias or the songs, whatever you like to call them, they really do soar extremely high into the soprano range. You'll hear both Gemma Sutton and Vicky Lee Taylor as Carrie and Julie Jordan, well, Julie and Carrie, that way around, going right into their whistle range to get the top notes. But they do it beautifully, and you know, you don't feel the breaks in the voice at all. So what they have done is almost to deconstruct the grandiose musical and try and stage it as though it were at a simple fit-up fairground in America. And they've shifted the time as well. We'll come to that in a moment. So there's an awful lot of kind of roustabout work done by the cast. They're hauling on ropes and bits of scenery are flying around above their heads as they raise the canvases to make a bit of scenery or to fabricate the carousel itself, and things are pushed around on wheels. And I know this can be a terrible cliche. They've done it at some playhouse lots and lots of times, but here it just worked a little bit better for me. It's very colourful, it's very energetic, and it moves the story along and moves the event along very fast, which is refreshing for Carousel, because it is 2 hours and 50 minutes and it can drag in a lot of productions. The other thing to say about the production is it's very naturalistic and very organic. They have decided not to use mics. It is entirely acoustically played and sung, so you have a very strong six-piece band, including a harp. I know you have to have some sort of angelic or heavenly references in Carousel, but to play it with a real harp rather than to synthesize it is terrific. And so much of what they play is really, really lovely. The songs are washed and refreshed in this musical production, and I really, really liked them. And somehow the blend of strong voices and strong band is never overwhelming. It's very subtle. And the songs are the musical direction of the songs is to take them as conversational. So not to treat them as the great big production numbers or anthems that they sometimes are. And that just brings freshness to them. You hear the words as if for the first time in some of the songs. And you know, when you get to a real set piece anthem like You'll Never Walk Alone, you know, we've seen that done in very statuesque ways. When they did it at the Savoy in that dreadful production with Leslie Garrett, she sang it gazing out over the heads of the audience as if she was announcing the end of the world. And the cast are all sort of reverentially stood and sat around her. And it just became too much like a Last Night of the Proms set piece, whereas the actress playing Nettie Fowler here does it cradling Julie in her arms with haltingness in her voice because she is comforting her cousin whose husband has died. It's just natural and beautiful and correct. So I have lots and lots of good things to say, but I think I should give somebody else a chance. Very, very good production, effortlessly strong performances. Tim Rogers, who plays Billy Bigelow, the male lead, the tragic hero, if you like, is outstanding. He's a youngish Australian who I wasn't aware of because I think since he came to the UK, he's done mostly touring, but very, very good. A little bit too sympathetic, possibly, because Billy is both a wife beater and a murderer or a would-be murderer. And you shouldn't perhaps warm to him quite as much as you do to this very handsome, very attractively singing voice. So perhaps a little bit too hard to dislike, but that's a really minor thing. It's a very engaging production. It's extremely well done. I cannot imagine how it could have a life outside an auditorium of this size because of the acoustic singing, but I hope it gets a second chance somewhere else because more people will want to see it.
Gareth, what did you think about it?
Well, I echo a lot of what John said, really, or all of what John said. I mean, we've seen lots of Rodgers and Hammerstein sort of rarer pieces on the fringe. You know, we've had things like Me and Juliet and State Fair and Pipe Dream quite recently. But I don't remember seeing any of the big five, as it were, Oklahoma and South Pacific, King and Iceland Music and this. I don't remember seeing any of them on the fringe, although John just mentioned Mount Fu School at the Landor. And if I'd been asked in advance, should you do this on the fringe, I probably would have said no, because it's always been in my head something that needs big resources, big stage, and how could you possibly make that work on the fringe? But of course they do. And the design, Stuart Charlesworth's design, is very clever, I think. And I think that adds something to it. But above all, I think it's the musical standards of this that are just so high. Mm. I mean, I echo the point about the harp, but actually the band is kind of almost like an acoustic band. There is an electric piano and there is some percussion, but they're played quite gently against acoustic flute, acoustic double bass and acoustic harp. So that enables them to sing without amplification, and that brings a purity, particularly with the girls, a purity to the sound that just takes your breath away. And the two girls, Gemma Sutton and Becky Lee Taylor, just are sensational vocally in this. I think the other thing this production does for me is in the second act, we sort of move to heaven, and that's when it all gets a bit sort of difficult, really. And in a lot of productions, it's very schmaltzy and very preposterous, frankly. And they kind of solve the problem of that. And somehow it comes out as being, you know, just a kind of moral, you know, a piece about morality, I suppose. And it, even though it's very moving, it's not schmaltzy. I mean, I was moved more by this production than any other Carousel I've ever seen. And I've seen the National Theatre one, the Opera North one, and indeed the Leslie Garrett one. But I was moved much more by this. And I think the handling of that sort of difficult second act is extremely well done, and that's what makes it very moving. But the performances, you know, I didn't find a weak link in them, really. Tim Rogers brings a kind of, for me, I take the point about sympathetic, but actually it is a kind of more rough and ready, more edgy interpretation, I think, of Billy than I've seen before. And I thought the lady that plays Hetty, she's much younger than I think it's normally cast. And I think that somehow made her more of a kind of role model for the girls, really. So I just thought it was a terrific production. This company, Morphic Graffiti, which is basically the director Luke Fredericks and the designer Stuart Charlesworth, they're producing this. This is the third show they've done, and I've seen the others. But this kind of elevates them, you know, again to another level. The first thing, the Revenge of Sherlock Holmes, that was the second. The first one was the Jekyll and Hyde at the Union, which I thought was very good. Not a great show, but a very good production. And the Revenge of Sherlock Holmes at Hoxton Hall was very good. But this takes them to another level, and I think this is just a brilliant, brilliant fringe musical. It won't transfer because, as John says, it can't. Its success is very much about its intimacy. It could, I suppose, transfer to an intimate theatre. But I'm probably going to have to go back because I think it's absolutely unmissable.
The other thing, of course, I didn't realise until too late is that Tim Rogers apparently was Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
Oh, yes, in the Union.
Yeah.
Yes, in the Union production, yeah.
I never saw it, so that would have been the outing that I should have noticed him in, but I didn't go to it. So.
I didn't see any of the other stuff, because as you say, I mean, in Australia, he appears to have done big shows.
Yes,
yes. He's been a kind of West End equivalent in Australia, but he's obviously making his name from the ground up here. It's very, you know, very good indeed. But, I mean, there was lots of...
Lots to laugh. But, yes, I think it's finished by the time I get back. Otherwise, I would also look to go again.
No, I think it's on till the 19th, and I think I'm going to pounce and book again before. Mm. I was actually, the night I went, it was actually incredibly empty.
Was it?
Just a tragedy. It was full
as a bull's on press night.
No, it was, but this was only one night later or two nights later, I think. It was Wednesday this week.
Paul had said something that it was very, very heavily booked through the run, and he thought that we might have been wasting our time in reviewing it because nobody would be able to get a ticket, but that seems not to be the case. But it's had five-star everythings. I mean, all the nationals loved it too.
And the five-star and the evening star. I went online this morning to look at the availability, and on the last Saturday, on the 19th, there's still about half the seats left.
Shocking.
Saturday evening. I just think that's just a tragedy, really. But maybe it'll build. Maybe, well, with those reviews, if they can't build it, goodness knows. There's no hope, really, isn't there?
No. Yes, that could be well true.
You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast page in Facebook, on the web we are AYULTP.com, and the podcast can also be found on both iTunes and Stitcher, where you can leave a review. Thank you. Goodbye.